Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Ann W. Smith, co-chair of the club's member-led arts forum. We welcome listeners on the radio, and we invite you to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org for information on events and podcasts. It is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Bernie Krause, musician and naturalist, director of the Wild Sanctuary, and author of The Great Animal Orchestra, Finding the Origins of Music in the World's Wild Places. And that's the topic of today's talk. Dr. Krause is a natural sound recordist and producer of a signature collection of ambient soundscapes. He began his professional career as a backup studio guitarist and musician for early Motown sessions in the late 50s while attending the University of Michigan. Where else? After graduation, he joined the folk group The Weavers, occupying the Pete Seeger slot where, with other members, he introduced the song Guantanamera at their legendary Carnegie Hall concert in 1963. When The Weavers disbanded the following year, Bernie and his late musical partner, Paul Beaver, helped launch the Moog synthesizer in the pop music and film media on the West Coast and the UK. His work is featured on many albums of that era, including those of George Harrison, Mick Jagger, and Van Morrison's bands, not to mention Beaver and Krause's own charted recordings. Bernie's contributions can also be heard on over 135 major feature films, like Apocalypse Now, Castaway, and Rosemary's Baby. In 1968, in parallel with his music production efforts, he began his second career as a founder of the field of soundscape ecology, recording, studying, and archiving the marine and terrestrial soundscapes of remaining wild habitats worldwide. While amassing one of the most significant collections of natural soundscape recordings in private hands, Bernie has also been engaged in the creation of dozens of natural sound albums representing threatened habitats. He also designs sound sculptures for museums and other public spaces worldwide. Committed to the creation of new language to describe the numerous fields informed by soundscapes, he is the author of The Great Animal Orchestra, the subject of today's program. Bernie, over to you.
Thank you, Ann, and it's an honor to be here, and it's so great to see so many friends, old friends, that I haven't seen in so long. The Great Animal Orchestra is the story of how animals taught us to dance and sing, and it's one of many narratives that are revealed to us through the voice of the natural world, its soundscape, which is really the overall subject of today's talk. And you can see on the slide here, how many disciplines are informed by the soundscape, and there are many of them that are discussed in this new book, The Great Animal Orchestra. But I've limited the subject of this book to how we became musical. And just as easily, I could have focused on medicine, the ways in which natural soundscapes help heal, or religion, the ways in which soundscapes inform spirituality, when we lived much more closely connected to the natural world. Or also recreating soundscapes for paleontology by looking at fossil records and then recreating those sounds and generating what soundscapes, what might have been like at the time of the dinosaurs. But this story begins at the end of the last ice age, and I'd like to share with you a short excerpt from my book, from the Prelude. It is 16,000 years ago, and the plains teem with life. With the presence of the giant armadillo, American cheetahs, saber-toothed tigers, giant beavers, mastodons, camels, caribou, dire wolves, and ground sloths that stand as high as 14 feet on their hind legs. Wildlife is everywhere. Humans haven't made their appearance in North America yet, but birds in great numbers, including pied-billed grebes, storks, Canada geese, ducks, teals, common crows, turkeys, bobwhites, dowagers, fill the air with flight and song. While tree frogs, peepers, insects, and reptiles saturate the sound field with the intricate tapestry of their voices. It is the end of the last ice age, and the leading edge of the massive Wisconsin Glacier slowly recedes to the Arctic Circle. With the Earth's warming, the floral world thrives. Pine, oak, spruce trees, along with larch, aspen, balsam, and poplar, have advanced far to the north, along with low-lying shrubs and grasses. The first signs of the boreal forest have taken root in the Western Hemisphere, and it thrives through the cold winters and the warm summers, and it is jam-packed with non-human life whose individual voices coalesce into an intense and collective symphony. The planet itself abounds with a vigorous resonance that is as complete and expansive as it is delicately balanced. Every place with its vast populations of plants and animals becomes a concert hall. And everywhere, a unique orchestra performs an unmatched symphony, with each species' sound fitting into a specific part of the score. It is a highly evolved, naturally wrought masterpiece. Humans, too, are making their sound heard. They are dispersing now, spreading across the planet, leaving behind tangible, visible, and acoustic symbols of their presence wherever they go. Detailed pictographs and petroglyphs, bone instruments, hunting and skinning tools, and evidence of larders to store excess grain which they've managed to harvest from early seed plantings. They're pulling together in larger and larger groups, but basically, they're still hunters. The forest is whispering to them, luring them in, and revealing where the objects of their hunt can be found. At this stage of their development, sound-rich habitats are humans' most significant acoustic influences. The sounds of animal life, organisms from microscopic to huge, and those from the non-biological landscape dominate the rather modest voices that humans generate. They have limited language skills to express what they feel, but they borrow some from what they hear all around them to convey emotion. Perhaps through their body movement and vocal responses, so evocative of successful life heard everywhere, these modern humans will convince the other creatures that they are all just an extension of one sonorant family. This is the tuning of the great animal orchestra, a revelation of the acoustic harmony of the wild, the planet's deeply connected expression of natural sounds and rhythm. It is the baseline for what we hear in today's remaining wild places, and it is likely that the origins of every piece of music we enjoy and word we speak come at some point from this collective voice. At one time, there was no other acoustic inspiration. I began my hearing life, because I don't see very well, by studying music. I studied violin from the time I was 3.5 years old, and composition from the time I was 4.5, and performed with orchestras like the Detroit Symphony by the time I was 13, and then switched to guitar. And worked my way through the University of Michigan playing guitar for Motown, as Ann said earlier. But when I tried to get into music school in 1955 with guitar as my major instrument, I was told by Juilliard, by Eastman, by University of Michigan, and many others, that guitar was not a musical instrument. Okay. Well, Never mind, I joined the Weavers, and after the Weavers broke up, I came out to California to study electronic music at Mills College. And when I was there, I met a fellow by the name of Paul Beaver. And Paul was a studio musician in Los Angeles, a keyboardist who had many strange instruments that he used on films like Creature from the Black Lagoon and so on, that some of you may have seen. Anyway, Paul and I got together and we pooled our life savings and bought one of the first Moog synthesizers off the line and introduced it to pop music and film at the Monterey Pops Festival in 1967. And we did an album called An Unsuch Guide to Electronic Music, which is still a standard reference in schools today. But our first album for Warner Brothers was In a Wild Sanctuary. And In a Wild Sanctuary had as its theme ecology. And it also meant, at the same time, that one of us, either Paul or I, had to go into the field and record natural sounds as a component of orchestration that we wanted to integrate into this album. And the job was kind of left to me, because Paul would have nothing to do with the outside world. And I was terrified of it, too. I mean, I grew up in a family where a fish was dangerous, goldfish. So I didn't know anything about it either, but I figured that the most dangerous place I could go was Muir Woods, just north of San Francisco. So off I marched into Muir Woods with a small portable recorder, a stereo recorder, which was available then, and also stereo mics, and turned on that recorder for the first time in October, not realizing, of course, that all the birds had flown by then and it was the fall. It becomes very quiet in Muir Woods. I turned on that recorder, but the space opened up in a way that was absolutely magical. And I decided right then and there, it was kind of an epiphany for me, I decided right then and there that this is something I wanted to explore for the rest of my life. Well, this is, In a Wild Sanctuary was the beginning of this whole journey for me. And we did a piece, one of the pieces that we did on the album, which included natural soundscapes, a stream actually, was called Walking Green Algae Blues. And Paul is on the Hammond organ, and I'm on guitar. And here's just a short excerpt. That album was the beginning for me, and it got me launched into this whole idea of recording outside rather than confined in rooms like recording studios, which I'd done for many, many years, even by that time. And as I began to record these sounds, I began to wonder how they were organized in the natural world. And what I found was there was a connection between music and natural sound. One of the first examples that I like to show is this is a score of the first page of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. And you notice how the sounds are arranged, how the instruments are arranged, from the very lowest at the bottom of the score to the top where the flutes are, the very top line. You can see there are probably almost, there are a dozen lines here or so. Well, how does that look? How does that translate into the actual ways in which we organize music? And here's a perfect example. This is a spectrogram, a graphic illustration of sound with time from left to right across the page and frequency from the bottom of the lowest from the bottom of the page to the top. And you can see, just like on that Beethoven score, the basses are here in the bottom and the flutes are way up here on the top. And I'm going to play this as an example. This is actually 11 bars of music, but you'll get the idea of how all of these voices stay out of each other's way, because if they're conflicting with one another, it causes a real problem. Mm-hmm. Well, how did we arrive at this organization of sound? And that gets us back to the idea of the soundscape. And the soundscape is a new word in our lexicon. It came into the lexicon in 1977 through a book that R. Murray Schafer, a Canadian composer and naturalist, wrote called Tuning of the World. It's a wonderful piece of literature that I recommend anybody get because it reads like a great novel. And the soundscape was important, but what I found in my work was that there were several different origins of sound in the soundscape. One of them, natural, which is the geophony. And geophony is all of the sound that is created, the non-biological sound that's created naturally in a wild environment, like wind in the trees, water in a stream, waves at the ocean shore, movement of the earth. And by the way, geophony was the first sound that was heard on the planet, and then it needed creatures to be able to hear it and find a place for themselves. And of course, that was the biophony. And the biophony is all the living organisms, the collective sound that living organisms make in a given wild habitat. These are non-human organisms. And they generate this sound, which I'm going to talk a little bit about, in a very organized way. And the more organized they are, the healthier the habitat appears to be. And the third is, of course, all the sound that we humans make, and I call it anthropophony. And anthropophony can be controlled sound, like music or theater or language, but most of the time it's chaotic and incoherent, and it doesn't really have concise information that it conveys to us. It's very confusing information. But biophony is by far the most important of these components. At least it is for me, and at least this is the relationship to music that I'm going to talk about. And like instruments in an orchestra, these organisms express themselves in both competitive and cooperative relationships to one another, just like instruments in an orchestra. Now, here's an example of another spectrogram. Again, this is just 15 seconds of sound, and it was recorded in Borneo in Camp Leakey, where Baruti galdicus rehabilitates orangutans. And we were there doing some work with the orangs. And although there are no orangs represented here, you can see that, again, the sounds in a healthy habitat are organized in a very precise relationship to one another. Here are cicadas filling three niches at the same time, three bandwidth that where there's no other energy so that their voices aren't masked. Here's the chestnut-winged babbler right up here on this line, about in the middle of the page. Insects are in the top quarter of the page. The Malaysian-eared nightjar is down here in the bottom, and then the gibbons, the mammals, are down here in the very bottom of the page. And this is what this sounds like altogether. And you can hear the whoop of the gibbons in the bottom. So you can see how that sound is organized. Well, humans are mimics, and because we're such great mimics, we mimicked not only the melodies and the rhythms that we heard in the forest, but we also mimicked the organization of stuff we heard in the forest. But I want to talk a little bit, I want to digress a little bit and talk about how soundscapes inform us about some other things as well, and just touch on them a little bit. This is a picture of Lincoln Meadow. Lincoln Meadow is about a 3.5-hour drive from here east in the Sierra Nevada Mountains at about 6,500 feet altitude. And it's a place that I've been recording at for many years. I started recording there in the early 1980s. And in 1988, a logging company convinced local residents that there'd be absolutely no impact, environmental impact, from a new method that they were trying called selective logging. So I asked them if I might record before and after the operation so I could see what the difference was, if in fact there was any difference at all. And if there was no impact, like they said, there'd be no difference. Well, here is a spectrogram of Lincoln Meadow, again, 15 seconds of time. And you can see in the bottom half of the spectrogram is the signature of a stream running through the meadow, and the top half of the spectrogram is filled with a signature of many birds. This is what Lincoln Meadow sounded like just before selective logging. ¶¶ And this is Lincoln Meadow a year later after selective logging, and you can see that the stream is still represented in the bottom half of the page, but notice what's missing in the upper half. Take a look, I mean, and listen to this. Here comes a woodpecker, a type of woodpecker. Now, I've been back to Lincoln Meadow 15 times in the last 25 years, and I've recorded at all times of the season and under a lot of different conditions. And I can tell you that the soundscape, the density and diversity of the soundscape has not yet returned to anything like it was prior to the operation. But this is a picture of Lincoln Meadow taken after selective logging took place. And you can see that hardly a stick or a tree is out of place. So too our eye, we're kind of fooled. But the ear never lies. As a matter of fact, while a picture may be worth a thousand words, a soundscape is worth a thousand pictures. Thank you. Well, you've just seen an illustration of the signature impact of resource extraction in a terrestrial habitat. But what happens in marine environments? Well, soundscapes are very important in marine environments, for instance, like living coral reefs. This is a soundscape, 15 seconds again, of sound represented at a coral reef. And you can see, again, in the bottom half of the page, this is all surface noise of waves at the surface of the ocean. And up here in the top, upper half are represented 11 different species of fish around this coral reef. And fish make a lot of noise from their swim bladder, that little air sac just below their spine. And they also make noise by oscillating their caudal fin. And they also create noise by gnashing their teeth and eating coral. So you can hear this. You'll hear some static and you'll hear some grunts and little things that are occurring here. They're all fish. Yes, but what happens when a coral reef is dying? How does that soundscape change? As it turns out, this is another part of that same coral reef about a quarter of a mile away, just 400 yards away. And you can see again that at the bottom half of the spectrogram is filled with the sounds of waves at the surface. However, in the top, notice how many species are missing. The only thing that you're going to hear here is a snapping shrimp, a small crustacean about an inch and a half long, that's snapping its big claw. And that's what the static is. Well, here's another example of sounds that are unusual and that we just don't think about. I was walking along the shore in Alaska a few summers back and came across this tide pool filled with a colony of sea anemones, those wonderful creatures. They're relatives of coral and jellyfish. And I was really curious to see if any of them made any noise, so I dropped an underwater microphone called a hydrophone, which is kind of covered in rubber. And I dropped it down the mouth part, the center part of this anemone right here, and immediately the tentacles began to search out the surface for something to eat, because that's what an anemone does. And so here's the static-like sounds of the tentacles kind of searching it out. And watch what happens here. And when it doesn't find anything of nutritional value, well, that's an expression that could be understood in any language, right? Well, the Great Basin Spadefoot Toad is a really great friend of mine, and it lives all over the high desert west. And what it does at the end of its breeding cycle is it'll dig itself down about a yard under the hard pan desert soil, where it can stay in a carapace, which it forms around itself, for many seasons, sometimes 7-8 years without ever coming to the surface again. And it's still alive. But when there's enough moisture in the soil, the carapace will fall apart and the frog will dig itself to the surface and gather in large numbers around these vernal pools. and vocalize in a pulsating synchronicity with all the other frogs around it for two reasons. The first is, of course, it's looking for mates, and it's got a very short period to do that. And the second is that it's looking for protection, because if all the frogs vocalize together in a chorus, it makes it really hard for predators like coyotes, owls, and foxes to pick out any individual for a meal. Well, this is a spectrogram which shows the chorusing of frogs in a healthy way. This is what they sound like. And this is a picture of Mono Lake, which many of you are familiar with. And Mono Lake is a favorite habitat of these toads, and it's also favored by U.S. Navy jet pilots who fly and train in their fighters coming out of Lemoore Naval Air Station in Visalia in Southern California, and also in Fallon Naval Air Station up near Reno in the north. So they converge often. And they fly over the Mono Basin at altitudes of just a couple of hundred yards above the ground level, and at speeds exceeding 650 miles an hour. They're very fast, they're very low, and they're so loud that when they fly, when the frogs are chorusing, when they fly by, even at 3.5 miles away, they cause the frogs to lose their synchronicity. And here's a perfect example of that. You can see that all of the energy of these frogs, this is a jet flyby, by the way, down here on the bottom of the spectrogram, you can see that all of the energy is gone in the upper half of the spectrogram, and that there are breaks at 2.5, 4.5, and 6.5 seconds. And this is what the frogs sound like when they're being impacted by human noise. Yeah. Well, but how did animals... I've always asked the question, how did animals get their voices? Because they're mimics too. And one of the things that we've found, which is I find fascinating, is that sometimes animals can get their sound from the geophony. Now, how does geophony inspire biophony? In this particular case that I'm going to demonstrate now, there are thunderstorms that occur at the equator, if you can imagine the sound of thunder in its normal state when we hear it. However, these thunderstorms transmit electrical energy through both the magnetic fields that move both to the north and south poles. And this electrical energy can be picked up by low-frequency receivers, which NASA has done. And this is what that energy sounds like when it's received at both poles, either one. Remember, these are thunderstorms. Okay. Now, this is a Weddell seal from the Antarctic. And Weddell seals have a certain amount of, like the other seal I'm going to show you in a minute as well, have a certain amount of magnetite in their head. And it's thought by some of the biologists that they pick up these sounds through the magnetite, and then they imitate them. Here's a Weddell seal in the Antarctic. Doesn't sound biological, does it? But here's the kicker. This is a guy who lives 10,000 miles away. These seals never come in contact with one another. It's a bearded seal recorded in the Arctic. And listen to its voice. I find that kind of things fascinating to me. This is just to show you what we learned from animals. We learn to dance with the deer. We learn to dance with the buffalo. And we learn to dance, of course, with the bear as well. And this is an example, a perfect example of music and natural sound. The Bayaka live in they're pygmies that live in Central African Republic in the Zonga-Songa rainforest, which is just to the southwest of that particular country in Africa. And the musicians there use the natural soundscape, the biophony, as a virtual karaoke orchestra with which they perform. In other words, they use it as their backup band. And here's a perfect example of that. This is a flute player here in the bottom, and he's playing to this frog line right here. This is a frog up here in the middle of the spectrogram. And you can see it, but you can't hear it because our ears aren't trained to hear these kinds of things and make this kind of discrimination. But this is an example of the relationship between our music when we lived more closely connected and the natural soundscape. What about music and nature? Well, in Western culture, we've been exploring this idea for a long time now. One of the first people to do this was Vivaldi, and Vivaldi tried to express the seasons through an orchestration. Well, imagine yourself as a 15, 16, or 17-year-old kid who really has no idea of what music is all about in music literature. What would he or she think if they heard this piece of music? The question, of course, is would it evoke spring for them? Same thing with Debussy. What would they think if they heard this? When I asked one student about this, what did he hear, what he thought about it, he said he thought it was something that George Lucas would use as a film score for one of his films. Okay, Messiaen. Messiaen was a French composer, avant-garde composer of the mid-20th century. And he'd walk through the woods with his wife Yvonne and in France. And he would notate only the birds that happened to fit the musical paradigm of the French Academy at the time. All the other birds were discarded. As a matter of fact, of the 10,000 birds that have been noted and as species, only 100 of them or so have been used in Western music. But Messiaen has used most of them. Here's Messiaen. Now, these next two examples are examples of two American composers who are using the same animal and expressing them each in a different piece of music. And I'd like you to try to guess which animal this happens to be. And if you happen to know the piece, please don't shout it out. Okay, this is Hovhaannes, Alan Hovhaannes. And here's George Crumb. Same animal now. Anybody want to venture a guess? Humpback whale. Okay. But what animal vocalizations happen to kind of make us feel good, like we understand what they're doing, and make us think of them as being musical. Here's a perfect one. This is a common potu, and a common potu is one of these critters that lives anywhere from Mesoamerica all the way down into the Amazon. And the common potu in this case sings the blues. Here he is. Not to be outdone, there's the musician wren. And the musician wren sings these short themes. And like I was saying before, we have the whole idea of the biophony is that these critters stay out of each other's way, not only in terms of frequency and bandwidth, but also temporally. And this guy will sing a number of themes, and when he gets to one point, he's in the middle of his theme, and a parrot interrupts him, and he's very polite, and he stops singing right in the middle of his theme. And then right after that, he picks up the theme after the parrot stops singing. And here's the musician wren. Listen to how musical this one is. Parrot. Coming up. Watch what happens here. Watch this. The guy didn't miss a beat. But why isn't this musical? My wife and I were in Ecuador on the eastern side of the Andes, down near, not very far from the Amazon on the Rio Napo, and came across this fig tree, and it had a hollowed out center. And down in the bottom of this hollow were two baby yellow-headed vultures. And I'm talking about they would fit in the palm of your hand. They were that small. And why isn't this musical? It's a perfectly decent bird. Remember, these are babies. And what's unusual about these critters is they're using the hollowed-out trunk of this tree as a tool. Resonate their sound and make it sound larger. You didn't want to put your hand down there, though. I want to talk now a little about animals and showing emotion. This is the story told by a beaver. And it's a very sad one, but it really kind of speaks to the ways in which animals are able to express themselves in ways that we're very uncomfortable with sometimes. There are a lot of older biologists who don't accept any of the idea that animals are other than animals. They don't have feelings, they don't have emotion, they don't feel pain or anything like that. That's very Cartesian. But a colleague of mine, Kurt Olson, from Minnesota, who's been recording around this very remote site for many, many years, happened to be recording there a couple of summers ago. And it's a pond that was formed at the end of the last ice age, maybe 16,000 years ago. And it was also formed in part by a beaver dam at one end that held this whole fragile ecosystem together. And he was recording one day, and all of a sudden there appeared from out of nowhere a couple of game wardens who had a stick of dynamite in their backpack and dropped it down the beaver dam, blowing it up, killing the female and her babies, because it was in the springtime. Horrified, my colleague remained behind to gather his thoughts and to record what he could the rest of that afternoon. And that evening, he caught a remarkable moment. And it's remarkable in the sense that I've recorded beavers for a long time now, and I've never got much more than a tail slap or a little cry, a little bark now and then. But this is absolutely remarkable. This is this lone male beaver swimming in slow circles, crying out inconsolably for its lost mate and offspring. This is maybe the saddest sound I've ever heard coming from any organism, human or other. What do beavers sound like when they're playing and they're really, you know, all together as a family? And here's a healthy family. I just want to show you the contrast of parents and young ones. And this is what they sound like in that environment. Because soundscapes are so new, and the idea of soundscape and soundscape ecology is so new, there we've run up against something that's really a problem as recordists and field biologists. It's really becoming more and more difficult to record in the field, largely because of disappearing habitat and climate change and many other factors that are taking place. Fully 50% of my archive comes from habitats that are so radically altered that they're either extinct or they can no longer be heard in any of their original form. And that's in 45 years. So it's really important to capture what it is that we can, and we're doing a lot to make that happen. In 2006, I took three teams to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and we were told before we went that, of course, there was nothing there because those who wanted to express that feeling really wanted to explore and develop oil drilling and gas drilling up in the refuge. And we said, okay, we want to see for ourselves whether or not there's anything there. And so we took three teams, and one of the teams was on the north, very north slope, very near the Canadian border, just at the Beaufort Sea, the edge of the Beaufort Sea. Another was uphill about 70 miles toward the Brooks Range, which you can see here diagonally across this graphic. And I was here just south of the Brooks Range in the tundra, but also the westernmost part of the boreal forest that stretches all the way from the Canadian Maritimes all the way to Alaska. And here's some of the sound that we were told by some politicians that weren't there. This is Beaufort Lagoon. Phalaropes, longspurs, and sandpipers. And you can see on the horizon just here, that's the Brooks Range looking south. And here's Sunset Pass, just up the north slope. This is looking north. It's a north view. And these are the sounds at Sunset Pass. Notice there are no trees, so all the birds are laying. They're creating their nests in the ground there in the tundra. These are blue throats, Smith's longspurs, red poles, and sparrows. And this is Timber Lake where I was, and you can see that there are trees there, mostly in the tundra. You don't find that. But again, this is the westernmost part of the boreal forest, and so there still are trees. And this is what Timber Lake sounded like. These are tree and white-crowned sparrows, longspurs again, and a ground squirrel. We also saw wolves and bear. It's a pretty extraordinary place where there's nothing, we're told. So it's pretty vital and alive. As a matter of fact, we had 21 sites carved out to land at, which we were going to choose at the very last minute. However, 18 of those sites we couldn't land at because the tundra had melted, and this was early June. And so the planes couldn't land because the tundra was too soft. In closing, we've heard a little bit about what these soundscapes can tell us, certainly looking through a larger contextual lens. And rather than older models of fragmenting these sounds into individual species, that has been done over most of the last century. And so there's a lot of stories that are revealed through this narrative that we're just beginning to understand. And with inexpensive and accessible new technologies that we're all coming to understand are available almost everywhere, it's my hope that a whole new dedicated group of citizen scientists are going to begin to explore and discover this world of soundscape ecology and to work with us to record these things and get them cataloged before they disappear altogether. And so there's really no end to this. This is just the beginning. And I want to thank you all for coming today, and I'll open it up for questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California and Ann W. Smith for the Member-Led Arts Forum. You're listening to Bernie Krause's presentation on the Great Animal Orchestra. Do we have questions?
Is this on? I think it's on.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. That was incredible. I'm wondering, like, birders usually know the sounds of birds, but you seem to know the sounds of the shrimp in the coral reefs and the fish and the names of all of these. How did you learn the names of all of these things making sounds?
I'm faking it. No.
I can believe it.
I don't know the names of many of these creatures. When I go out to record in new places like in the Amazon or where there are thousands of species of birds and insects and frogs, I just don't know the names of all of the creatures, of course. But I usually work with local biologists who do know those names, and I'm very careful about archiving them and keeping good metadata on all of the things that I record. And we're discovering new things all the time, things that we never thought made noise, like, for instance, viruses. Every living organism makes a sound and has a sound signature.
It's all vibration.
It's all vibration, yes.
You touched briefly on the jets going over Mono Lake, but I wonder if you could address the incidence of noise pollution, human-generated noise pollution, a little further, what your experience has been in some of these remote places that are just no longer quiet.
Well, noise pollution of most people, and in the United States, the Office of Noise Abatement was closed down by a fellow by the name of James Watt during 1982, during the Reagan administration. And he was a wonderful fellow, had some interesting things to say, like, for instance, when he did that, he said, noise is power, and the noisier we are as a country, the more powerful we appear to be to others. So the only federal group that's dealing with noise issues in the United States is the FAA, oddly enough. And that's just noise issues around airports and flying over national parks. And those are the only controls that are here in America. Now, having said that, there are some recommended noise levels which we should not exceed, like 80 dBA. However, in Europe, in the EU, it's almost half that at 72 dBA. So, and that is law. So in the EU, it's governed by law, and you can't exceed that. Here in America, there's no law at all. It's just a recommendation. And it's left pretty much up to the local and regional government to decide what's too loud. So, in effect, there's really nothing happening here.
What bare-bones equipment would you recommend for citizen soundscape scientists?
There's equipment that you can buy for $200 and under. That's wonderful digital stereo equipment. That's every bit as good as the kinds of gear that we were using 15 years ago that would cost $15,000 or $20,000. So these, and you just go online and look at for stereo digital recorders, and there'll be hundreds of them coming up and lots of pages and lots of prices. I mean, they range all over the place. But for $200, $300, you can outfit yourself with a terrific piece of equipment.
Hi. My name's Eric, and among other things, I'm a jazz musician and composer, and I wanted you to, if you could elaborate on the emotions that we get from some of these samples and maybe a more anthropomorphizing or the narrative. And specifically, I heard your the beaver sample in an interview you did with David Byrne, and I was also very emotionally upset by it. Yeah. But part of it is the story. If you tell the story and then you have the sample, there's such an emotional reaction. And today I was wondering about that sample, and if I had walked, I used to live in an area with beavers, and if I had been walking by my pond and had heard that sound, what would I have thought? And the first thing that came to mind was, well, that's one horny beaver. But to hear the story that this is an area that was destroyed, and I was just wondering if you could comment more on what our narrative brings to these samples or how that, I believe that that is an emotion that that beaver is expressing. But.
Yeah, I do too.
Yeah.
And I'd have no problem defending it at a science conference or anything. The, you know, we don't know a lot about natural sound because we haven't spent a lot, like I said, we haven't spent a lot of time really thinking about it and recording it and comparing it. I do have an example, like I played today, of the beavers before, you know, under a lot of stress. One under a lot of stress and others playing. But I've seen things happen in when working with in Diane Fossey's camp, in the late Diane Fossey's camp with mountain gorillas. I saw this female carry around her dead infant for days, you know, just moving back and forth and just whimpering, you know, alone by herself away from the rest of the group. So I've seen these kinds of things happen before with other animals. I've seen elephants picking away at you know, a dead mate or even a graveyard, a boneyard of elephants that have been poached in Africa. So I've seen a lot of this kind of example. We've certainly seen a lot with dolphins and other critters. So it doesn't. It's not limited only to mammals and you know, more evolved critters on the planet. It's pretty much wide-ranging as far as I can tell.
Hi, thanks for your presentation. I was wondering, you made the distinction between the biophony and the anthropophony, but since we're animals too, I was wondering if you had studied or had plans to study kind of the human soundscape, maybe in absence of machines, but just humans, you know, and do our speech patterns and our noise patterns fit into the same kinds of patterns you showed in the biophony?
Yes, they do. And again, the people who live in a less mechanized world and who don't have a lot of leaf blowers and stuff to make their lives more complicated and loud, like the Bayaka, for instance, their language and their music is completely evolved from this natural soundscape around them because they're connected to it, they're involved with it, they're engaged at all levels all the time with not only the soundscape but the smells and the tactile aspects of their lives. So and they watch animals do certain kinds of movement. For instance, we got drumming from watching those bonobos and chimpanzees beat on the buttresses of fig trees and watched as how those signals carried far into the distance and would affect other groups because those signals carried information. And we'd watch groups do aversion behavior and run away because it meant war or gather together because it meant food. We've seen a lot of that happen. And I just think that it's much more pervasive than we just on the surface are acknowledging right now.
brief follow-up. Can you also comment on what happens if you do include all of our machines and our other kinds of sounds? Like, what are our urban soundscapes like?
Well, you saw what happened to the frogs. And so what happens is it eliminates, if there are birds that need to be heard in a certain kind of way, and the signatures of human endeavor, like those leaf blowers or lawn mowers or straight piping motorcycles, if those are somehow impairing those creatures' abilities to vocalize and have their signals expressed, then it's not going to work. And there's a lot of that going on right now. That's why we just have a few birds in urban areas.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where we have time for only one more question.
Okay.
Next.
So, Dr. Krause, for the longest time I was playing various sort of 85 different bird sounds from Sweden put together by one of the ABBA's technicians. And I would sit in Glen Ellen on a small country road on Trinity, and the neighbors would look out and say, "Where are these birds?" And they came from my car, you know.
Yes.
So I've been looking for a long time for your CDs to see if I could again play some American or Indian birds or whatever, and you had a CD some years back, but
thank you for that. We no longer manufacture CDs because it was too resource intensive to do that, and we just didn't want to put any more plastic in the world. So you can download them, however, off of our website, which is wildsanctuary.com, and there are many albums from many habitats that are under a lot of pressure right now, and some don't even exist anymore. So you can get them.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We really appreciate it. Wonderful presentation. Dr. Bernie Krause. Thanks to our audience here today also. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 109th year of enlightened discussions, is adjourned.